Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books and Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown. And today I'll be talking to one of the editors of the co-edited volume, Black Politics in Transition, Immigration, Suburbanization, and Gentrification. The book is published by Routledge University Press. The two editors are Candace Watts-Smith and Christina Greer. I have Candace on the phone with me today. Candace, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you, Heath. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great. You have been on before. Your co-editor has also been on before, but this is a chance for you guys to come together. I'm sure what was a fun book to put together. Maybe you can just remind us about your background and also Christina Greer's.
Okay. So I am currently assistant professor of public policy at UNC, Carolina, Chapel Hill. And I study racial and ethnic politics, but also social policy and inequality. And I guess I suppose I should mention, just kind of because we're talking about this book, is that I come from people who come from Mississippi, who moved to Chicago, who moved to North Carolina. So this project is near and dear to my heart because I'm not really sure we talk enough in political science about just kind of the political geography, especially in Black politics. Chrissy is associate professor of political science and American studies at Fordham. And she, you know, we have so many overlapping interests in Black politics and in the diversity of Black politics. And she's just also an expert on local politics and in urban studies as well.
Yeah, she sends her regrets on not being with us today, but we're going to try to make do and do the best our job to talk about this really, really interesting book. The title suggests a change in Black politics, but it also alludes in some ways to a change in the study of Black politics. I wonder, when you were thinking about this volume, what comes before the transition? Where has the study of Black politics been in the past? And you know, what have been the prominent themes then? And then we'll talk about the transition to kind of how you guys are putting together your book.
So I would say that over the past couple of decades, political scientists, especially folks who study Black politics, have really leveraged national level data to tell us all sorts of really important things about Black political behavior, Black ideologies, representation, questions around Congress, and you know, once Obama came in, obviously, what a Black president meant to American politics and Black politics in particular. But I think that in that we kind of lose the nitty gritty and the details that happen at the local level. And so, historically, if we kind of think about Du Bois, and of course we can debate if he was a sociologist or whatever, but, his work was at the local level. Drake and Caton were at the local level. And so I think we need to do more of that work because there is more diversity and variety in Black politics, and we see it best, I think, when we look at the local level. And so I was really motivated to highlight that and highlight the work of people who are showing the complexity of Black politics. It looks homogenous at the national level, but when you get down to the street level, to the neighborhood level, to the city level, you really get to see variety and diversity.
Now, this suggests the opening for your exploration of these transitions. You have three major sections. They may not actually fall into three sections, but three major sort of themes throughout the book. What are those categories of transition, and why were these the most important to include in the book?
Well, and I want to be careful to say that immigration, suburbanization, and gentrification may not be the most important issues in Black politics. I mean, I think those are probably issues around equity and, you know, policing, education. But I think it's been overlooked the what happens when people move around. What happens when people are interacting with people that they may not have interacted with before? What happens when people are provided a greater opportunity to move to a different space? And so that's why this book focuses on immigration. And immigration here means both the immigration of newcomers, non-Black newcomers to the U.S., as well as people from the diaspora. Suburbanization is a reference to the fact that we tend to think about Blacks as being located in highly segregated inner cities, and most Black people actually live in the suburbs, and there needs to be kind of more attention to that. And then gentrification is maybe just because I live in Durham and I kind of see the effects of gentrification is what happens when upper class and white folks move into what have traditionally been predominantly Black neighborhoods. What are the new dynamics there? What are the new challenges there? So we're just kind of motivated to think about perhaps these issues that haven't been highlighted that ought to be.
Yeah, and you know, there's this great section of the book about Durham itself. Now, in every great edited volume, there's usually some great origin story. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you found the authors of the chapters of the book. Was this the result of a workshop or some other process to cull these experts together? So, give us your origin story of this book.
So, to be honest, I really think that it's important to highlight work on the cutting edge of research. But I think that, and you can tell me what you think, Keith, that sometimes that work gets marginalized in major journals, that people want the cutting edge, but when it comes around, people say, well, is this really a thing? Or is this really worth studying? And so I felt that these authors were doing work at the cutting edge of Black politics, that they were asking questions that we don't typically get to ask in the JOP, in the APSR, in AJPS. And so that's how they were chosen, that these are experts in an area that just isn't, you know, that areas that aren't getting enough attention but ought to be.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and this is illustrated by some non-political scientists among the authors of these chapters, sociologists who are weighing in on Black politics with as much authority as political scientists, and probably relates to that very point that you just made. Now, the first major section of the book is focused on immigration, and the chapters are written by Sharon Wright Austin, Corey Charles Gooding. Maybe you can sort of talk a little bit about what you learned from these authors about how immigration has changed Black politics in recent times.
So this section of the book, I think, helps us, again, to understand, they do two things. They help us to understand the political ramifications of ethnic diversity among Blacks, and that's something that Chrissy and I have both written books about, as has Sharon. But it also, these works tend to be focused on New York City. And Sharon's chapter is focused on New York City, but Corey's is not. And by juxtaposing the two, we really get to see how location and density of a particular group can influence people's identities, can influence whether people think that it's worth piping up for their ethnic group, or is it better to just kind of blend in and have a greater kind of racial consciousness. I don't think that we would get to see this diversity if we only focused on a place like New York City. And so I think that's one of the reasons why Corey's work, generally speaking, is so important, because it challenges us to say and highlight the diversity, the ethnic diversity of Black folks across the country.
Yeah, you mentioned this before, but the suburbs are a major part of the book. And I think a surprise for those that haven't been studying Black politics closely. We learn a lot in this book about suburbanization. And we don't just learn just sort of some demographic patterns. I learned some very surprising things that were different from what my expectations were about the Black politics in the suburbs and the politics of African Americans who have moved to the suburbs compared to those that are living in cities. Were you surprised at all by some of these findings about attitudes and levels of sort of how radical one's politics are based on where one lives?
Well, I mean, for example, Ernest's chapter, what I love about it is he goes, let's just relook at all of these things, and, you know, gives us a really great retrospective that I think that we have made some assumptions and using the kind of maybe, you know, the methods, you know, that we weren't able to use in the 80s and 90s. Right. And just to kind of relook to see if Black suburbanites are more conservative, as many suggested they did. But also what Ernest does in his chapter is to say, you know, we tend to think about Black suburbanites as being so far away from Black people, and really they weren't. And even just kind of reorienting ourselves to the idea that the kind of geography of opportunity did expand with, you know, the fair housing laws and other anti-discriminatory laws, but didn't expand that much. It expanded right off of the periphery. And so his work does kind of a really good job of highlighting that. Ruelle's work also on suburbanization, and I like that they're together because they don't totally agree with each other. And it's just kind of worth thinking about, well, if we look at it this way, we might see it, you know, and as people being more radicalized. If we look at it another, we can see people actually differentiating themselves. And again, it's these things are worthy of study and debate in order for us to better understand the evolution of Black politics and what our expectations are moving forward. So that's what I loved about those two chapters and having them in conversation with each other.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that we learned is Rhoyal Rogers is an excellent writer. I mean, not just researcher, but just the quality of the prose as his editor for this volume must have been really enjoyable, because just the you read a lot and you read a lot of great research. Not all of it is as well written as his chapter is. It was just such a pleasure.
It's beautiful
to read the prose. The final section of the book is focused on gentrification. As you mentioned, you live in a gentrifying area, as do I, in Brooklyn, New York. Is what we are observing in Durham and Brooklyn indicative of how gentrification is working across the country? Some of the chapter research takes this look at a more national level, and how do things look in terms of gentrification and where people are living across the country?
So I would say that maybe gentrification, I think, is our shortcut word for kind of neighborhood change, and we typically think about gentrification as like middle class white folks moving into different neighborhoods that have been predominantly Black, and we use this word gentrification in the title because you can't say immigration, suburbanization, and racialized neighborhood change.
Right.
And so I would say that really the chapters are about that, and also kind of Andrea and to some extent Niambi's chapters are about these local neighborhood changes. But I would say that people, even for example, when we sent the book out, someone said, "Why are you guys talking about Durham so much? Why aren't you talking about Baltimore, Chicago more, or New York? That's where most Black people live." But Durham is a mid-sized city, and Durham is a place that's more like other cities than Chicago or New York, right? That there aren't that many Chicago or New Yorks in this country, but there are plenty of Durhams, right? There are Tulsas, there are, Charlottes, there are Richmonds, right? These are these kind of mid-sized cities that are seeing vast neighborhood change. And what I like and think is helpful about, Sada's chapter in particular is that we tend to kind of have a ethos that progress, that moving up in social mobility is going to get Black people equity and equality. And what we find and what Sada finds is that when you show up into air quotes, nicer neighborhoods, Black people may be policed, right? They're trying to live the American dream and they are policed by their neighbors. Or that, middle-class white folks are moving in and they are going to police the people who have been living there. And so an improvement in the neighborhood standing, maybe in the neighborhood amenities, may also come with some important challenges to the people who were already there. What I think is really important about Jessica's chapter is that she kind of gives us a remix on the South, that we all have this idea that Black people in the South are particularly oppressed. And what she shows is, one, is that, there's racism all over this country, but turns out that because of the geography of the way that the space is laid out in the South, there's actually greater opportunities for middle-class Black people, especially to own homes, to go to college, to use their degrees in an occupation that kind of matches what they're doing in a way that we don't necessarily see in the Northeast or Midwest.
Now, Chrissy writes the concluding chapter of the book, and she's not with us to talk about it, but I wanted you just to maybe wrap up our conversation reflecting on something that she wrote, because it does sort of cast a way to think about the future. She writes, each of the three largest U.S. cities has had one elected Black mayor in their city's history, David Dinkins, Harold Washington, and Tom Bradley, with no real contenders being groomed for the future. Currently, as of the writing of the book, Of the top 15 largest U.S. cities, only one has a black mayor, Houston. What does the sort of the conclusion of the book and this part of it, these just facts, say about the direction of your research and the research of this combined group of scholars over the next period of time? What is it? What are the themes going to be in the future if this is sort of where we are right now in terms of leadership in cities?
So I mean, I think also kind of what Chrissy says there in Andrea's chapter, which shows that there's a majority minority city that is gaining more in capital, that we should expect Black people in this city to get more of what they want. And that's not what we're seeing. And what I think Chrissy's observation and Andrea's research and all of the chapters together show is that there are new challenges, that some of the things that we thought, okay, people get a greater opportunity to move into the suburbs, that people have more Black political representatives, that gentrification brings in new capital to cities. And so we don't have the empty promise. But there are new challenges that arise even after we get the things that we thought that we wanted. And maybe our study moving forward requires new definitions, or perhaps just requires reevaluation of our theories that we just thought that if we got A, then that would be a positive outcome for Black folks. And here, what we're seeing is new challenges. And I think that what this means for political science and Black politics, generally speaking, is that we're going to have to go back and reassess some of our predictions and make new ones.
Yeah, the title of the book, again, is Black Politics in Transition, Immigration, Suburbanization, and Gentrification. The book is edited by Candace Watts-Smith, who you've been hearing from, and Christina Greer. The book is published by Routledge Press this year, 2019. Candace, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Heath.